Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Alexandra DeSanctis of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. But we still, of course, have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives as we wrap up the week. And as we continue in this podcast today, we'll be getting a better idea of who actually is a conservative in elective office and who might just be pretending to be one. Alexandra, always great to have you. And let's start with a good martini that you have written about recently, and that is the effort towards a family leave bill. A lot of people like the idea, of course, of having flexibility when a new child is brought into the world without having to worry about the finances of it. But from a conservative perspective, we also don't want a massive new entitlement program that would add to federal spending. And so what Marco Rubio and Ivanka Trump have essentially come up with here seems to be a pretty smart way to do that. What they're essentially proposing is that parents can still take those weeks off, and they don't have to worry about the bills piling up because they can draw early from Social Security in exchange for a promise to wait later when they retire for those weeks to go by before they start getting those Social Security benefits for the rest of their lives. And so you not only wrote about that, you wrote a response to Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post, who thinks that that's unfair for some reason to families and more unfair to larger families. And she basically concludes that the only way you can really do this right is to have a new tax, of course. So first of all, what do you make of the Rubio-Ivanka Trump plan, and what do you make of Brunig's one-size-fits-all approach here?
Well, I think the plan itself is great. It was actually developed in a policy paper by the Independent Women's Forum, and then it was sort of pushed on the Hill, and Rubio, Ivanka Trump, Mike Lee, Joni Ernst, a few others have kind of, you know, signaled support for it, and Rubio and Ivanka in particular are now pushing it on Capitol Hill, hoping to get it into legislation soon. And I think personally that it's brilliant because, again, as you said, it doesn't require creating any new entitlements. It's just a shifting of existing Social Security benefits to when a family needs it most. And this is something I wrote a little bit about in my piece earlier this week. But, you know, we hear all this about how Social Security is meant to function as insurance and it's not welfare. And so if it's insurance and you're paying in to draw on it when you need it, this should be exactly how it should function, because parents are able to draw on it when they need it. And if that's when they have a new kid and want to take a few weeks off work rather than, you know, when they hit age 66 or whatever the retirement age is, then that's exactly how Social Security should function. But in terms of the critique, so Elizabeth Brunig's a Washington Post columnist, and she suggests that this plan is actually punishing parents and families for choosing to have a child. And I think that framing of it is just honestly kind of ridiculous, because it's a freely chosen shifting of the exact same benefits. So it's giving parents flexibility that they don't have right now to draw on this insurance program in order to enable them to take time off. No one's forcing them, A, to have a kid, and B, no one's forcing them to draw on those benefits if they don't want to. If they'd prefer to retire when they had planned to and draw on Social Security then, that's fine. They're welcome to keep doing that. And if not, then they make alternative plans. But to me, I think it's perfect because it gives parents freedom. And if then, say, they delay their retirement benefits on the other end, they can plan in advance to save up extra, given that they're going to delay retirement just a few weeks. So I think it's really conservative and it's pro-family and really doesn't require much of a change at all.
Yeah, the cost on the back end compared to the benefit of getting it up front would seem to be pretty minimal. What's the read that you have so far on this? Is this something that is pretty popular on Capitol Hill, or are most people, especially on the left, I'm guessing, more like Brunig, thinking that if this is going to happen, the government's got to get its fingers all in the pie here?
I think it really is the latter on the left. This hasn't gained a ton of traction yet in terms of getting into legislation, so I'm not sure exactly what the reception will be. I know there are at least a handful of Republican senators who like it, but I do think, again, with this casting of it as a punishment, the idea that if we're not giving parents an additional benefit, somehow this is a detraction. Like, they should be getting money, extra money, when the child is born from the government, and then also money exactly when they were promised it at retirement. That's sort of the tone I'm seeing on the left. But I think in any event, this gives parents a lot of flexibility they don't currently have. And so it's clearly an improvement on the status quo.
Yeah, there's a lot to like here. And I just thought of one other thing that people are probably going to like. If you take the money when you have your kids for several weeks at a time, you're upping your chances of actually getting some Social Security benefits as opposed to for young workers to wait all the way to their 60s and 70s, given the way our Congress is spending right now. The odds of it actually existing then seem to be getting lower by the day.
That's an excellent point. I didn't even think of that, but that's brilliant.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I try. All right. On to the bad martini now. And this is when the Republicans are not going to look so great here in the bad and crazy martinis. Both of these related to the new two-year budget deal. It's passed the House. It's passed the Senate. Actually, the Senate passed it first last night in the wee hours. The reason for that we'll get to in the crazy martini. The final vote in the Senate was 71-28 in favor of this thing that's going to bust the budget by about $300 billion. Some say $400, some say $500 billion when you add in everything over the next couple of years. 15 Republicans, only 15 out of 50 that were there for the vote actually voted against this. Also in the House of Representatives, most Republicans voted for it, 167 of them to be precise. Only 67 Republicans voted against it. The pluses, of course, is that it gives some more certainty on spending and budgeting going forward. Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, was arguing for that. It does repeal the so-called death panels, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, and does some other things. But it also jacks up domestic spending, right along with the military spending. So we're once again headed towards trillion-dollar deficits, and we'll get to that in the next point. But the one thing that I think, even if some Republicans were holding their nose and thinking, well, maybe we just need to do this and hold our nose and hope for the best, Alexander, they're also giving up, essentially, reconciliation. From what I've read, there might be a couple of avenues to still do it, but it's going to be much harder to do. And reconciliation is the budget tactic in the Senate by which you only need a simple majority to pass things. That's how we got the tax cut. That's how we tried and failed to get a repeal of Obamacare last year. And we've heard about all these big ticket items coming up, welfare reform, entitlement reform, maybe another stab at Obamacare. Good luck. That's not going to happen anymore. And Republicans pretty much did this unilaterally.
I know. This drives me absolutely crazy because growing up, so I kind of got into politics around the time that the Tea Party became a thing, and hearing all this talk from Republicans when Obama was in power and when Democrats had Congress of, well, if we could just get the House, then maybe we could get something going. And now we just need the Senate. Just give us the Senate because we need both chambers of Congress. We can get some bills going. Oh, well, now we need the presidency because who's going to sign the bills? Okay, well, now you have all three and you're still giving up just immense leverage to Democrats when you don't have to. It drives me absolutely crazy.
No, that's exactly right. And so much for the ambitious agenda. I mean, it's not that often that you get Republicans controlling the White House, the House, and the Senate. So now is the time to strike while the iron is hot. And as we've been saying here on the podcast over and over and over again, if Republicans want to have a prayer of keeping these majorities later this year, actually getting done what you promised to get done is going to be a big part of that. And handcuffing yourself on all these big ticket items coming down the pike is not going to help. If you think you're only going to get things done and get reelected based on a tax cut when all these other promises went unfulfilled and you're jacking up spending, they probably have another thing coming.
Especially when it's just a trade-off for, I mean, they already passed their tax reform bill, so they got that done. Now it seems like they're just giving up all of this leverage mainly to get increased military spending, which not even all Republicans support. So it's kind of, I think it's sacrificing a lot for very little gain. It's not like a really helpful compromise for the party.
Amazing. All right, let's go to the crazy now, which has obviously direct connection to this. Rand Paul went to the floor of the United States Senate in advance of the vote on this major budget bill and funding going to March 23rd and setting the parameters for the next 2 years. He didn't like it very much. He says, first of all, we just got this thing at midnight. It's 700 pages, so obviously no one's had the chance to really go over this thing. And he says it busts the budget caps, and that's his biggest thing. So he simply wanted an up or down vote on an amendment to honor the previous budget caps, which he knew would fail. He had a phone call with President Trump and admitted, I'm probably only going to get 15 to 20 votes on this, but I want to get it on the record. The leadership would not do that. So therefore, Rand Paul took to the floor for a number of hours and held up the vote till very early Friday morning. But here is one of the most succinct summaries that Paul gave for why he's doing this and why he's appalled at what Republican leaders are doing here.
The exchange you just watched was me asking to have a 15-minute vote. I've been asking all day. I've been asking all week for it. We could have literally had dozens of votes today, but we squabble because people don't want to be put on the spot. So the reason I'm here tonight is to put people on the spot. I want people to feel uncomfortable. I want them to have to answer people at home who said, how come you were against President Obama's deficits? And then how come you're for Republican deficits? Isn't that the very definition of intellectual dishonesty? If you were against President Obama's deficits and now you're for the Republican deficits, isn't that the very definition of hypocrisy?
That did not sit well with other Republicans. John Thune, member of the leadership, a colossal waste of time. Richard Shelby, he's tilting at windmills. Don Quixote, you know. Mitch McConnell got up and said he reminded the Senate that President Trump supports the bill and Senator Paul does not join the president in supporting the bill. So if he doesn't agree with the president, so what? Senate Majority Whip John Cornyn, perhaps the worst on this, blamed Paul directly for, quote, wasting everybody's time. It's just grossly irresponsible, Cornyn told reporters, explaining why Republicans would not grant Paul his amendment vote. Why reward bad behavior? Tom Tillis of North Carolina also upset with this, saying, do you want to be a senator that wants to make a point, or do you want to make a difference? You know what? I don't see how points alone can make a change in America. So, Alexandra, I might be wrong here. I might be cynical. I don't know. I don't think Republicans are as upset as they claim to be that this vote took place at 1:30 in the morning, although I'm sure they're not thrilled to be there. I think they're more upset that Rand Paul called them out for hypocrisy and not wanting to have to take that vote.
I think that's true. I mean, they couldn't, none of them even tried to refute the substance of what he was saying. He was clearly correct. And I mean, I will admit that Rand Paul is known for doing some grandstanding now and again when he knows he's not going to get anywhere. But again, this is part of the Senate process. And these people are all pretending, these other senators are pretending he's, you know, holding up the way things are supposed to go. But nothing, there's nothing in the Senate rules saying that a senator can't do this. It's explicitly provided for because things like this happen where one person in the party thinks the rest of his fellow senators are making a big mistake. That's how it's supposed to function. And on top of that, I mean, none of these GOP senators are acknowledging the fact that they're a huge part of what drove the government to the brink of shutdown last night. They weren't there until midnight solely because of Rand Paul. They were there because they couldn't come up with a deal and they were trying to ram through this huge spending deal at the last second. So blaming it all on him seems to be a little bit too convenient.
Yeah, obviously, filibuster is a bit of a grandstand, and maybe he could have wrapped it up a little bit earlier. Watching some of the older senators trudge around the floor at 1 o'clock in the morning was a little bit painful. But, you know, that's part of the job, too. And as you pointed out, the filibuster, I think he deserves a plus for the filibuster. I think people who actually take to the floor, whether I agree with them or not, and stand their ground is much more impressive than just killing a cloture vote and not getting to 60 votes and claiming that as a filibuster. So ultimately, what do you make of the Republicans now heading into the midterm elections here? Effectively, yes, beefing up military spending, which they did promise to do, but not holding the line on spending and now owning trillion-dollar deficits.
I mean, to be honest, I'm pretty disgusted. I'm not even surprised. I've gotten used to this kind of stuff at this point, I guess, but it's just very disappointing to see.
Does this mean that Republicans, at least the majority of Republicans, aren't serious when it comes to this stuff?
Oh, very much so. I mean, they've been swearing up and down for years that they want to, you know, get rid of deficits and cap spending. And then when push comes to shove, they just completely jump ship.
Alexandra, it's great to have you today. I'm sorry we had such depressing news in the last couple of martinis, but always great to have you with us and have a terrific weekend.
Been a pleasure, Greg. Thanks.
Alexandra DeSanctis of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. Jim will be back on Monday. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend, everyone. And please do tune in on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.